Do we have a quorum? Four, yep.
We're going to call to order the meeting of the Senate Committee on Education today, February 19th, 2015. Those of you who were here last Tuesday understand that we actually pushed everything over today. So today's schedule looks very cramped, and we're going to try to get through as much of it as we can. So we're going to try to limit each of the bills to like 15 minutes. They're all public hearings today. If it takes a little longer, we may have to move some stuff onto the next way, but eventually we will catch up. That's the fun part of the fun part of being in the legislature, where you never know what's going to happen on any particular day. So so with that, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 219. And with that, we'll have a short explanation by our administrator. We'll go from there.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 219 directs the Legislative Assembly appropriations for public universities and Oregon Health and Science University to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission rather than to the Department of Administrative Services. A fiscal statement has been issued. There's no revenue impact, and there are no amendments being considered at this time.
And we'll invite Dana Richardson up.
She looks an awful lot like somebody that used to work in the president's office, doesn't she?
Well, yeah. She does.
Yeah.
And other places before that.
Yeah, that's true.
She looks like somebody that went to the University of Washington. That's an exciting thing, too.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, Chair Roblin. For the record, my name is Dana Richardson, Deputy Director for Legislative and Policy Affairs at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Senate Bill 219 has a couple different aspects to it.
Dana, could you pull the mic a little closer, please?
Sorry, Senator. There are two provisions that specify where appropriations for public universities and for OHSU would go. They would both come to the HEC to be appropriated and allocated to the institutions or the Oregon State OHSU directly. So those are a couple cleanup provisions. Right now, for the university, statute is silent. For OHSU, right now, their appropriations go to DAS before they go to the university. So doesn't change the amount that the university would get. It says for direct appropriation in the end statute. The other provision is that our commission can currently take action if a majority of a quorum of members are present, which we feel like is a bit of a low bar. There are commissions that are set up that way, but we feel like given some of the allocation decisions that the commission would make, that a higher bar of a majority of the members would constitute the number that you would need to take action. So that's what we have before you today. I believe OHSU has submitted a letter of support. I could drag a university person up there if you'd like.
So
or DAS, for that matter.
Right. They are complaining that they don't have to pass it through.
So was that their suggestion?
Okay. Any questions of...
Just want to make sure thank you, Ms. Chair. Make sure I understand. You know, I mean, we're just shifting where the money goes, but I mean, you're talking about the council isn't. Once we have allocated, then we've made the decision where the money goes in the budget. It's not for HEC to do that, is it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, with regard to OHSU, that's the case. With regard to public universities, the HEC has authority to allocate the dollars that the legislature appropriates.
Okay.
And in the past, what happened is we sent it all to DAS. DAS then sent part to HEC and part to OHSU. And now they're going to say,
right,
just send it to the first place.
It just all comes to one spot.
And quite honestly, my concern was I don't want HEC messing with OHSU. So,
and they can't do that.
Okay.
With this bill. This bill does not allow that.
Clarification. That's it.
Any other questions? Okay. I see none.
Thank you.
There was no one else that signed up for this bill. Is there anyone that is sitting out there that just can't wait to come up and say something? I see no one rushing to the front. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 219, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate 219. So with that, Senator Cano.
Well, Chair Roblin. I move Senate Bill 219 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cano moves Senate Bill 219 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, Is there any opposition to Senate Bill 219? Seeing none, bill passes, and
I think Senator Gelser
to
was opposed, but you know.
Okay, we don't know. Should we have her carry? Is there anyone that would like to carry this bill? Otherwise, I'll carry it. It doesn't matter.
I think you should.
Okay, I will carry the bill. So with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 219, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 218, and we'll have a short explanation from our administrator.
Chair Roveland, members of the committee, Senate Bill 218 authorizes the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to charge out-of-state schools a fee of $7,000 for degree authorization and $1,000 for new program applications, practicums, or internships based in Oregon. It additionally authorizes a fee of up to $1,000 for new career school program applications. Senate Bill 218 may have fiscal and revenue impacts, but statements have not yet been issued at this time, and no amendments are being considered.
So with that, let's have Dana Richardson, who is here today. And do you want Joan? Do you want Joan up with you as well?
Juan.
I'm sorry, Juan. I knew it was Juan. I saw Juan yesterday. Sorry about that one.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Chair Roveland, for the record, my name is Dana Richardson, Deputy Director for the Higher Education and Education Coordinating Commission. I'm here. I just wanted to give a little bit of introduction to this bill and introduce our Director of Private Postsecondary Education, Juan Baez Arevalo. A lot of people know that the HEC is combining with the Community Colleges and Workforce Development Department, as well as the Office of Student Access and Completion. Not everybody knows that really the core of the agency when it first came into being was the private postsecondary schools. So that includes our Office of Degree Authorization, as well as the private career schools and veterans programs. So this bill is focused on those two units, and I just wanted to provide that context and turn it over to Juan with the chair's permission.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Juan Baez Arevalo. I'm the Director of Private Postsecondary Education for the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Before I go into the details of Senate Bill 218, I would first like to share with you a bit of background and our need for this bill. Then I will cover the key details of what we seek to accomplish with SB 218. As Ms. Richardson described, the goal for the units under the Office of Private Postsecondary Education is to be self-sustaining through program fees. In the last few years, the Office of Degree Authorization, ODA, has seen an explosion of online instruction and program offerings, which has added complexities to the oversight and authorization of out-of-state postsecondary degree providers and credit course offerings. With this growth comes a vast array of student and consumer protection issues. ODA fee schedules for out-of-state providers have not kept pace with the costs and the increased workload for regulating complex and ever-changing instructional delivery systems. An obvious fact that in-state private institutions shared with me soon after I took over the role of Director of Private Postsecondary Education. This afternoon, they will be presenting to you their testimony in favor of SB 218. As will representatives of public universities who support treating out-of-state providers the same as they are under the State Authorization Reciprocity Agreement, or SARA. Another issue that has arisen with out-of-state providers is the placement of students in practicum experiences in Oregon. For example, an institution back in Chicago or Boston might place a Master of Science nursing degree student at a clinic in Oregon to complete her studies. These institutions must submit to the HEC a supervision, coordination, and assessment plan and meet the requirements set by the Oregon Board of Nursing. As I will explain shortly, SB 218 would assess a fee for review of these placements. Private career schools also fall under the purview of the office that I oversee. This office conducts significant work to review and approve new programs. At this time, we're not assessing a fee for that work, which diminishes our opportunity to review new program submissions promptly. Now, what we seek to accomplish with SB 218. Section 1 of SB 218 clarifies that out-of-state institutions must obtain approval from the HEC prior to beginning operations in the state or offering new programs. Out-of-state institutions seeking to enroll Oregonians will have to do so by one of two gateways, through participation in SARA in their home state, or be authorized by the ODA. Section 1.6 clarifies and imposes fees to non-SARA out-of-state distance education providers who are offering courses or programs in Oregon or adding new programs. Section 1.7 establishes fees for practicum placements in Oregon by out-of-state institutions. It would allow the HEC to waive the fees for one-time placements or special circumstances involving Oregonians. Finally, Sections 2 and 3 allow the HEC to impose a fee of up to $1,000 for each new program application submitted by a private career school. This fee would allow the Commission to recover costs associated with the complex task of reviewing new program proposals. In sum, SB 218 allows the Commission to recover oversight costs for regulating out-of-state institutions operating in our state, for new program approvals, and practicum placement review and approval. I should also let you know that we have requested an amendment to this bill in order to align some program descriptions with those that are currently enrolled. Ultimately, this bill is about ensuring that there's proper state oversight of private and out-of-state institutions and that the interests of students as consumers are protected. Thank you for taking time to hear this bill. I will be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this applies to private online courses like and as well as bricks and mortar like a Phoenix University or out-of-country university that might offer an online degree?
Chair Roblin, Senator Beyer, this applies to institutions that are outside of our state. For example, an institution that might be placed, let's say, in Connecticut that is seeking to enroll Oregonians and to offer programs in Oregon. Institutions like University of Phoenix that have a campus in Oregon, the activities of that campus are already regulated by the ODA. Other institutions related to that, located outside of the state seeking to offer programs, will have to review if that's in conjunction with the campus here or if it's totally directly from that other institution from outside the state.
So if a university, say in Colorado, private university is offering online courses, they're not specifically offering them in Oregon, they're just offering them online. Are they covered by this if an Oregonian enrolls?
An institution in Colorado would be covered most likely by SARA, by the State Reciprocity Agreement. That agreement allows institutions in other states that are members of SARA to offer courses and programs here in our state without having to go through ODA approval. If the institution in that SARA member state chooses not to get SARA approval in their home state, in that situation, that institution will have to get approval from the ODA prior to enrolling Oregonians.
How would you know?
It is difficult to know. And this is where it gets complex for protecting consumers, because oftentimes when we find out, and the web is very vast, as you know, there are many institutions seeking to offer degrees and programs. And when we find out, is usually after the fact, when the student is having issues with the institution, whether it's access to what was offered or the lack of support to the student online, or there's some reimbursement issues, or even worse. And this is where it gets critical, Senator. When the student seeks to finish that degree and get properly licensed in a profession in the state of Oregon, particularly one, whether it's a counseling degree to be out of school, or a master's of teaching, or a nursing program, or psychology, a degree in psychology, and then we discover that institution A is not properly accredited, and B, that degree would not be valid in Oregon, and that student is at a total loss. Mm-hmm. So we want to create the proper screening mechanisms. The SARA agreement allows us to do that with our member states, those that join in, which facilitates that online commerce. But for those who choose not to use that agreement, to not be pre-screened, to verify that they're authorized, that they have the proper credentials, that they have quality programs, then they have to go through the ODA. It's the right way, it's the right thing to do to protect consumers. We're trying to protect consumers at the front end.
So how many states are members of SARA?
You know, that number is growing. I would hate to give you a number, Senator Pryor, because right now in the West, I think just about everyone except California is a member state. And California has other issues. Which, Chair Roblin, it would take me a very long time to describe all the issues in California.
Oh, just
but we are seeing an expansion of every week, I mean, not every week, but every other month, every other quarter, a new member state is added. Missouri, I think, recently was just added. So we're seeing the Midwest, part of the East Coast, also being added. Next week, there's a meeting with the Southern region and Southern member states, I think, just have a couple of things they want to look at in terms of SARA and join SARA. So it's expanding.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one of the concerns that I've always had is, frankly, it's more on some of the private vocational training programs. Lots of advertising, lots of come on, and the question is, once someone goes through and completes the program, is there an accreditation there that anybody really recognizes, the business community? Does this get at that?
Chair Roblin, Senator Beyer, this gets at those that are offering courses or degrees that are generally accredited. Mm-hmm. Those who would not be, who are not accredited, we would obviously deny through the ODA. For private career school side, institutions that are advertising in Oregon, they would have to have already had approval from us under the private career schools unit. So there's two types, those that are fully accredited and degree granting, and those that are accredited but not degree granting.
And SARA is fairly new. We passed that legislation
just last April, and Oregon, we became members in December.
And one other clarification on that. You know all of the programs that are accredited in Oregon.
Good idea.
And so if a fellow SARL state called you, you could tell all of them which ones we have accredited in Oregon. And that SARL state could tell you all of the organizations that are accredited in their state. So the question is, after you see somebody coming in, you could check with that state. They say they're from you. Are you accredited? If they say that, yes, they're a member, they've gone through the SARL thing, then you don't have to do any more. It's only if they are not a SARL member and you can't confirm that they are.
Chair Roblin, that's correct. Once they're a SARA member and they've been approved in their home state and through the national review, they get listed on websites from that state, websites from NC SARA, and then our schools that are already approved by NC SARA are already listed on our website. So, okay.
Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. I'm confused. Is it SARA or SARA?
I go both. It's SARA.
It's a good spelling. So does the HEC consider an organization to be headquartered in Oregon if it has a presence here? I'm thinking specifically of the DO school, the Comp Northwest in Lebanon.
Senator Roblin, Chair Roblin, Senator Gessler, yes, we do consider that institution in Lebanon to be an Oregon institution because the campus is in Oregon.
Okay.
So they've established a physical presence in our state.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions for these witnesses? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next we have Jeff Ng. And I always do that right.
Good afternoon, Chairman Roblin and the committee. I'm Jeff Eng, and I am the Oregon State Director of the Northwest Career Colleges Federation. Those of you who are not familiar with our federation, we are a nonprofit membership organization committed to the advocacy of private career schools in the state of Oregon. Our position on Senate Bill 218 is a support of the bill. It, as Mr. Baez had previously commented, our membership had voiced concerns about the unfair advantage that out-of-state schools have compared to those located here in the state of Oregon when it came to fees paid. The Federation, of course, realizes that additional expenditures are not always viewed favorably, but we do believe in a reasonable cost for the regulation of out-of-state schools that is now being currently paid by the in-state schools and members of our federation. Given that out-of-state schools pay comparable services to our in-state members, our membership believes that the service cost should indeed be comparable. And we believe that this legislation will eliminate that inequity that currently exists between the in-state schools and the out-of-state schools receiving services.
So any questions for this? Again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Is there anyone else who, is there somebody else on there that would like to testify today on this bill that's in the audience? Thank you. I would like to note, in case you have some late-night reading and you need to have some reading to do, in OLIS online, there's a lot of testimony and materials that have been sent in on these bills. So it's always good to go and look at OLIS and see the stuff because that is part of the record. And there, for today's work, there's a lot on there. So just thought people should know that in case they had not chosen to look there at this point. Again, anyone else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 218? We don't have the last amendment that we're waiting for, so we're waiting on that bill. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 218, and we will open a public hearing. And so far, 5 minutes ahead of time by the first two, so that's impressive. Senate Bill 113, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 113. We'll have a short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 113 requires the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to determine definitions for employee categories at post-secondary educational institutions. This bill may have a fiscal and revenue impact. Statements have not been issued at this time, and no amendments are being considered at this time.
And I don't see Senator Dembrough yet, but we will wait and watch. So right now, let's have John Wyckoff and... we can have Shauna come up as well from Portland State. Yes, come on up. And anybody else you want to bring, that's great. Thank you, John.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association, and I wanted to share some of our thoughts and some concerns with the concept in front of you. Having spoken at length with the sponsor, we do really appreciate, I think, what in part of the intent of this is, which is, as it has been described to me, to sort of get to the kind of the heart of and in some ways dispel the myth around in community colleges, the idea around sort of whether there has been management bloat. And I think we would argue over the last, since over the recession, our enrollment went up about over almost up 40%, while our state funding went down about 20%. So we were doing things like truncating departments under, so a dean might have three different departments under them, or the person who did human resources also became your Title IX compliance officer. And so we got to the point where most of our colleges were putting what had been single roles into three and four roles into one person. And I think when you're looking at things, especially sort of like risk management and compliance, you get to a point where it's not appropriate, where it's not a particularly appropriate level of oversight. And so one of the concerns and what this bill asks us to do is to look at
is to sort of expand some reporting that we have been asked to do in previous bills, where we are looking at kind of the ratio between full-time and part-time staff. But then this one asks us to look at the ratio between management and positions that are considered non-management and compare that to student FTE. We have a couple of concerns with that, with the approach. And the first is that it sort of implies what could be an inappropriate baseline, that if the baseline is starting now and then you say, well, if you've increased your management, you are thusly you have bloated your management. Well, if that is to restore levels of staffing that are more appropriate and that lead to sort of better oversight, we wouldn't want the impression that that was an acceptable baseline. Now, one of the ways that this bill sort of tries to deal with that is to do a retroactive look back about 5 years. That would be quite an administrative burden and a costly burden, taking people who are already doing, like I said, three or four rules into trying to create and then crosswalk this information. I'm going to talk a little bit about why that's difficult. But in 2009, we were asked in House Bill 2557 to compare, as I said, the salary and benefits between full-time and part-time employees, and then to sort of have, you know, a universal way of looking at that on each campus. Then the difficulty with that, and where this took hours and hours of representatives from the different campuses trying to get together and to create common definitions, is these are collectively bargained definitions at the 17 colleges. So these are different at every college. And it became sort of a process of trying to find ways to compare these definitions between each college, make them match up. It's cumbersome. It's difficult. They're all defined differently on each campus. And so it was a report that ended up having an awful lot of asterisks to it that were where you had to be sort of footnoted. Let me just read a really quick excerpt from the report we were asked to do. And it said, it is understood that using the workload rate does not result in an apples-to-apples comparison because the workload rate for full-time faculty is based on the totality of the faculty role, not strictly limited to instructional hours, prep time, and grading time. Report narrative will caution about comparability due to the differences in roles and explain that there is no way to develop a formula with an apples-to-apples comparison due to the differences at the colleges. I'm just trying to give you kind of a picture of what the difficulties were and why this created sort of an administrative headache, and it was that was in some ways costly to try to put all of this information together. And I think you'll hear the same from, I mean, I think it was a similar, the universities have some similar concerns here as well. So in 2013, we were asked in House Bill 2152 to expand the reporting to more what is in this bill. But we the compromise was to use IPEDS data, which is the national sort of data warehouse that higher education in which we put our data. It stands for the Integrated Post-Secondary Educational Data System. This at least uses a format that the colleges already do. So this didn't require extra work, extra staff time, extra money. It was a way to do it where we're using reporting we're already doing. I think the concern from Senator Dembro and proponents of this bill is that the data isn't particularly doesn't cover everything they want to cover. I mean, that's an issue with IPEDS data in a lot of areas. But it is at least consistent, and it is at least in a format that doesn't require sort of reinventing a wheel in a costly and cumbersome way. The last issue I want to touch on before turning it over is what this also does is ask the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to sort of be the crosswalk, to sort of figure out definitions that will be universal. And we know from working on this is a very cumbersome task. And every session since the HEC has been in existence, we micromanage it in this building. We come up with 7 or 8 work groups or task force or different things that we want the HEC to do, and it takes them away from doing the work that we have tasked them to, that is in their mission. And we would have a concern that this is sort of another example where we're micromanaging the HEC and asking them to do work that they're not asking for and that they're not setting out as this should be a priority for us. And we think this puts them on sort of another, well, in this case, maybe a bit of a wild goose chase, but it micromanages the work they do, and we have a concern with that. And with that, I would be happy to answer questions or just turn it over to my colleagues.
Senator Dembro's here. Do you want to make a statement now before, or do you want to wait and hear these three?
Maybe it would be better for me to sort of get the background.
Okay. That would be good.
You guys can sit. Go ahead and stay, and I'll just jump up.
Okay.
We'll bring you back, John, when we have questions.
Thank you very much. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Michael Dembro. I represent Senate District 23. That's Northeast and Southeast Portland and the City of Maywood Park within the City of Portland. I'm sorry that I couldn't be here to actually lead this off and give you the some of the background to it, so I think what you're getting is a kind of collage where you're putting the pieces together, which I know you're all very capable of doing. But let me just tell you where this came from. We started working on this, on the issue of reporting workforce information from our colleges and universities back in 2009 with House Bill 2557. And there we were, among other things, that bill was trying to get at the question of, to what extent are our institutions relying more and more on part-time faculty? So it had to do with the ratio between part-time and full-time faculty. And that bill passed, and subsequent to that, we began getting annual reports on that, which we can then look at and see how are the different institutions doing in terms of the ratio of full-time to part-time, and also, and this is perhaps even more significant, what is happening within each institution, over time, to see if they are hiring more or having more of the teaching load being carried by part-timers versus full-timers. And within that report, there we had two separate reports coming in, one coming from OUS for the universities, which gave us actually a very good coherent report on the universities, which was easier for them to do because they were all part of OUS, and OUS was able to pretty much use comparable data. They were using the same set of definitions for all the universities. It was trickier for the community colleges. That came through the CCWD, Community Colleges Workforce Development. And there, because you had, as I think Mr. Wyckoff was just saying, you have 17 colleges, and people use somewhat different definitions. The CCWD was not really charged with bringing coherence to those 17. I would say from our purpose in understanding what was going on in the colleges, it was less useful, actually, than what we were getting from the universities. Having said that, I totally understand and appreciate the difficulty of, 17 different colleges with their own boards and their own ways of doing things. Last session, in 2013, tried and somewhat successfully to take what we were doing with the part-time, full-time issue to look at, so how are the other employment groups doing? What kind of labor trends are we seeing there? And a lot of what was provoking that interest was, all of us who work in education policy know, there are concerns out there that we're seeing too much or more of resources going towards administration, out of the classroom and towards administration, what people out there refer to as administrative bloat. And so, the question was, well, so what does the data tell us in terms of whether, are we seeing growth in administration, growth in the amount of institutional budgets going towards administration? So how much is going into management? How much is going into student support? How much is going into classified, et cetera? Now, on the faculty side, it was easier because most of the faculty are covered by collective bargaining agreements, and although it was somewhat tricky, it was less tricky than coming up with an apples-to-apples way of doing it with management and administrative staff. And so, you know, finally the group, we had a work group that was working on this in 2013. We decided, okay, we can't get there. We'll use the IPEDS, which is that national reporting system, which does give us consistent numbers, but we all agreed those are bad numbers. But for now, those were the only numbers we had. And so we actually put a provision in 2152 that that said recommended that the HEC, which is now collecting all this information, will include in the report ideas for how we could move to a better system. And that's what this bill does in 2015. It actually charges the HEC with coming up with the common definitions that we can use so that for the colleges, for the universities, we are dealing with apples to apples kinds of comparisons. And I would argue that that is one of the reasons that we created the HEC, was that we simultaneously created the HEC and we gave more autonomy to our universities to give them the more flexibility, as the community colleges have. But knowing that, we knew that we needed this Higher Ed Coordinating Commission to do the overall coordination and to help us to come up with consistent ways of looking at things. So that's what this bill does. It calls on the HEC to, over a long period of time, create the definitions that would get us there. You know, the understanding, the way the HEC operates, the HEC, one of the primary HEC roles is to convene stakeholders to work on what would be the common definitions. So that's what this bill does. It also cleans up. There's some date reporting problems that were in 2152 that this bill would simplify those so that there's, you know, it's one report comes in on a certain date and everything is clear. So that in a nutshell is what this bill is. And I know that there are some concerns out there about it, and I'm happy to do whatever we can to address those concerns in order to get to a bill that does what we need to do to solve this problem. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So any questions of the senator? We'll fill the rest of them later and then come back. But I just want to make sure that people clearly have an understanding of where we're at so far. Okay.
Great.
Thank you very much. And I will take you at your word with respect to wanting to help. So if we decide that maybe some people should get together to see how to work this out, we'll make sure that you're engaged.
With you, Senator, the price is always right.
Good afternoon. I'm Shanna Sechrist. I'm the Associate Vice President for Human Resources at Portland State University, and I am here on behalf of the seven universities, public universities. And this is my second time at the Capitol. My first time was last week when we got to meet, Mr. Wyckoff and I got to meet with Senator Dembrough and others to talk about the bill, understand what the goals were, and start to brainstorm on ways to get what we all agree we want, which is affordability and quality in higher education and transparency, including transparency in our workforce. In talking through the bill, it's clear that we want to understand what the cost drivers are for higher education, and I wouldn't be a good representative of the universities if I didn't say the biggest cost driver for students is the disinvestment in higher education that's happened over the last 10 years, and certainly share Mr. Wyckoff's concerns about getting so lean in some areas that we're no longer doing the jobs we should be doing to cover things. I think my counterpart who was here on Tuesday at Southern Oregon has three titles: affirmative action officer, head of HR, Title IX coordinators at many universities across the country. Those are three separate jobs, so those are concerns. And more practically, looking at how would we take seven different universities that are different in mission, different in size, different in scope, different in workforce, and apply uniform definitions to them, that becomes concerning because they're not necessarily apples to apples, although there are ways you can look at them. And I would say with the classified staff, who are staff who are represented by the SEIU, that's fairly easy. We have what's called a classification and compensation system across the university, so that a locksmith at PSU is a locksmith at OSU, and they have roughly the same job duties and the same pay structure. But for the universities, that's really where it ends. For our relationships with our administrative staff and our faculty, those differ from university to university. And as an example, at Portland State, both are what we would call full-time, but other universities may not, faculty are represented, as are our part-time faculty. And so our definitions of who those people are have come up, you know, through bargaining and through negotiation and those things, and that differs from university to university. So I'm concerned about the difficulty of fitting everyone into classes without so many caveats that the information becomes meaningless. So I think working to get a system that gets the transparent information is important, but I'm concerned about the rubric here, that we wouldn't get it and that it would be very difficult to get there. You know, as an example, faculty play many different roles, right? They're teaching instruction, but they also might be the primary investigator on a grant and have some supervisory responsibilities, you know, or be at an institute. There are so many different roles they can play. Where would they fit in these categories? I think could get pretty challenging. And then just some logistics around retroactivity and making dates match dates we already have to do reporting, things like that. So we would really like to get the information that's being looked for, but we're concerned about how it's being asked for here. I think it's the best way I can say that.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, Senators of the Committee. My name is Frances Kelly, and I'm here on behalf of Klamath Community College. My title is Vice President of Human Resources and Institutional Effectiveness. And I'll try to limit my remarks to those that my colleagues on either side of me have already expressed, because those are some of the very concerns. And I did actually submit my testimony in writing as well, so you can check that out later. I do have one correction, though, in the second to last paragraph on the first page where I make a reference to 2014, it should be 2013. That was a typo on my part. My major concern on behalf of Klamath Community College is that we're 17 colleges, we are unique. You've heard this before from my colleagues. But we really are, in that we have very different populations that we serve as well, and very different missions. For example, in Klamath County, we have a 56% high school graduation rate, which is appalling. And so we're a big focus of ours is that we're constantly preaching the gospel of post-secondary education, the need to have one or you're going to be poor, and that this cycle of generational poverty is never going to be broken except for that avenue out. And so it's already been pointed out that we are so lean as it is administratively, and we're already, our knees are buckling under the burden of all the compliance matters that we have to attend to already that are imposed on us by the federal and the state government, particularly in the area of, well, there's Title IX, there's Title IV, which is financial aid. We have to keep a close eye on the default rate. We all just, some of us just had a really close call with that. There's family medical leave. There's Violence Against Women Act, there's the Clery Act. There's so much that we have to do and that we have to keep our eyes on. And I think that most of those things are extremely worthwhile because they have as their purpose to protect students and employees against injustice and against being taken advantage of, or against not knowing that, for example, there's been a string of sexual assaults on campus. Makes sense. But this, I think what Senator Dembro is proposing, and I have great respect for him, and I'm certain that his intentions are good. I don't mean to cast any aspersions on him or anyone else here, but it's just not worth it. It's everything in life is a trade-off, and you only have so much time. And for us to focus on this when we're trying to, in my case, lift this county out of this poverty that they're in with the limited resources that we have, I understand the desire to standardize. It makes things simple, but a lot of things aren't that simple, and they really aren't subject to being standardized. And I firmly believe this is one of those things, that it just isn't susceptible of being standardized. We just went through bargaining in May, and we tried to do this for our own purposes to compare salary and so forth, and it was extremely time-consuming and arduous to try to normalize these things. For example, you can't just look at salary. Some of the colleges pick up the employee's 6% PERS contribution that they're required to make. Others don't. That makes a big difference in the bottom line of compensation. Health insurance is offered to employees at all different rates in all different ways across the 17 colleges. There was no way to normalize or compare that. Workload is so different. There's prep time, there's overtime, there's advising, student advising, there's club advising. There are just so many factors there that it's really not possible. I mean, this is a great idea in theory, I think, but it's just as a practical matter, it doesn't work. And then when you compound that with the fact that those measures, these standardized definitions of what's a full-time employee, what's a part-time employee, and so forth, that then we also need to look at, well, what's a workload? What's this ratio of employees? What's this ratio of students? Our student population fluctuates. It's like a Trailblazers game. It's like they're in, they're out, they're in, they're out, they're back again. Then they leave, they have a baby, they have a seasonal job where I live because it's agricultural, and then they come back. Any time that you're going to monitor our student population and the levels at which it stands, it's a snapshot and of that particular moment in time, and it could be very misleading. And that's why it's important, I think, when you look at least student population of at least my community college where I work, you really have to have longitudinal data. It just doesn't, because you need to let that equal itself out, the in, the out, the, you know. Another thing about this that I spotted right away that's problematic is that it calls for the data to be submitted in the current, that's for the current academic year, and it has to be submitted on October 1st. Well, the academic year runs summer through the following spring, so on October 1st we have only data for summer term. So I don't think that's very useful, and maybe fall term may be like 3 days old, but for iPads we don't count that until the fourth week in October, because then we've done the ad drops and so forth, and it's a much more reliable number. So that's even like a functional problem that I see with this particular iteration of this this Senate bill. My main point here, though, is that I just don't think the community college, I think they're just such an animal that they really can't be standardized. But also, major thing, you have to look at, is the game worth the candle? And in this case, I just don't think it's a trade-off that's worthwhile in terms of what it's going to cost us with staff time and taking our focus off other things that, in my judgment, are more significant and more directly address our mission as the college to serve as the possible only way out for the community that we serve out of this cycle of poverty they're in. I just don't see that this really adds to it. Okay. Thank you.
Any questions for people? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the people who were signed up. Is there anyone else that would like to speak to Senate Bill 313? 113. Thank you.
Thank you.
Seeing none, I will get a hold of Senator Dembro and ask him to get a hold of some of the people that spoke here today to see if they can come to some kind of agreement before we put this bill back on the loan. So with that, we'll close this public hearing on 113. We'll open a public hearing on 303. And we'll have a short explanation by Gretchen Enbring, our administrator.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 303 requires school districts to submit proposed funds diversion agreements to the state treasurer for review and approval, and prevents districts from entering into funds diversion agreements unless the agreement is approved by the state treasurer. This bill may have a fiscal and revenue impact. Statements have not been issued at this time, and the -1 amendments are going to be considered.
Laura Lockwood McCall first. And there you are. Thank you very much.
Can we turn the screen on?
We'll get it there. It'll
okay.
Be fine.
For the record, my name is Laura Lockwood McCall. I'm the director of the Debt Management Division in the Oregon State Treasury. In one of my other capacities, we prepare the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission report annually for consideration by the legislature and the governor's office. And this is an issue that I'm going to talk about today that we've been talking about in our SDPAC reports for a few years. And the issue before us is the state guarantees of local school district and community college debt. I need to give you a little background to explain SB 303, if you'll indulge me. Back in 1998, and I believe Senator Beyer might have been part of this, the legislature authorized the state to enter into guarantees for local school district and community college debt. And by that, if we basically reviewed in the treasurer's office their GO bonds that were voter approved, we basically put the state guarantee, which is our state credit rating, on these local school district debt. And it was a great program. It saved them money because it lowered their borrowing costs. And it was a state aid intercept. And to date, no school district has ever stumbled and been unable to make their debt service payments. And so it's really very much a contingent liability as opposed to a hard liability the state has to worry about. But what has happened since the meltdown of the stock market and the bond markets in 2008 is that bond insurance companies are no longer around. So we're really the only game in town if school districts who don't have our credit rating want to use the program. The chart shows that from 2005 to 2014, the program more than doubled in size. And this just shows you overall debt service that's been guaranteed. In any given year, I'll show you a chart in a moment that shows you what annual debt service. And again, it's just a guarantee. It's a contingent liability. We haven't ever seen any out-of-pocket from the state. So in 2001, the legislature authorized a second state aid intercept program, and that was for pension obligation bonds, which is what this bill talks about. In that case, various associations, including Oregon School Board Association and I believe the Community College Association, did pooled financings. And in that case, these state guarantees actually took real state aid. Every year, the Department of Education sets aside a portion of school aid, and that money goes to the bond trustee that makes the debt service payment. And that same kind of guarantee, because the money was moved over, provided additional credit quality to those bonds, and they were able to borrow at a lower cost. In total, there was $3.1 billion that was sold in POBs with these fund diversion agreements between 2002 and 2007. When we were rewriting the public finance law several years ago, one of the things we noticed was there was these two state aid guaranteed programs side by side. And we asked ourselves, what if, heaven forbid, there was ever a conflict, which program would get the money first if there was a limited amount of state aid? And we did clarify in law that the school bond guarantee, which came first and which has a constitutional basis, would come first. And then the pension obligations would come next. But the treasurer's office, and I guess this is the heart of the matter, really wasn't involved in the process. And in our old debt tracking system, we knew the overall amount of bonds that were sold, but we couldn't get down to a school district by school district basis and really look at all of this principal and interest that's been guaranteed. And that's really the new thing that we've been looking at the last few years, because we now have a new bond tracking system where we can drill down and actually see how much money has been basically guaranteed. And what we discovered, and this is first showing you on a combined basis, is that that combined number is really growing. The red indicates the annual debt service that's being paid on the pension obligation bonds, and that's real money that is really going out the door. Now, that was structured so it was upward sloping in terms of its amortization, and it's roughly now at about 8% of all school aid. The blue is the contingent liability that I mentioned, and the green line shows you on how that's been growing as a percentage of state aid. So throughout the state now, fortunately it dropped in 14 and 15 as state aid improved, but we were pushing almost over 20%. So, you know, again, in a school district by school district basis, that's our deeper concern. But we feel like it's an important consideration for the SDPAC to just see what the trends are. What we were able to do, the state GIS system, was to show you for 2014 on a school district by school district basis where each school district stands in terms of its debt service guarantees versus its state aid. And what struck us was there was a few school districts and there's a few community colleges I'll show you in a moment where when you take the combined debt service for pension bonds and school bond guarantee, it exceeds their state aid. And that's our concern, is we don't want to preclude people from doing pension bonds in the future if that's what the school district chooses to do. But we think that there probably ought to be an upper limit on that combined basis. So in the last year, we tightened the rules for school bond guarantee, and we look at the combined basis. We say, what is your OSBGA and your pension bond? What's the total? And we'd like to keep that at 80% or lower. And we have put that into administrative role. Now, if it's higher than that, we've offered, they can offer collateral or bond insurance. But again, we're just concerned in a worst case scenario, if the state really had to come out of pocket, would we really take state aid? Probably not, because the school district couldn't function or the community college district. But we think it's important from a fiscal perspective to at least put some limits around it. So this is just currently, and I can tell you about specific school districts if you're interested, but those three sticking out, two of them are very wealthy school districts that voters have approved a lot of property of GO bonds, and they have a strong property tax base, and they may not get as much school aid. So that could explain it in part. In the case, and this is the community colleges, we have a few on the coast where they may not get a lot of community college state aid, but when you combine the debt service guarantees, in one case they're at 100%, in one case they're approaching 100%. So what we'd like to offer in 303 is an ability to review these POBs if they come again and probably apply the same 80% rule. And that's really the end of my presentation.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Green, OSBA.
What a nightmare. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green representing the Oregon School Boards Association here today in opposition to Senate Bill 303. As you've heard from the state treasurer's office, this is something that school districts, their boards, duly elected, community colleges, their boards, duly elected, take a look at and do. I think the school districts that she's mentioned up there, you have to take a look at where they're at. Several of those school districts don't receive any state aid because their local revenue is in excess of what would be coming to them from the state school fund. Those are generally our coastal districts, Neocony, Seaside, those districts that still have large timber income coming in from local. They don't receive state aid. We have six school districts in the state that receive no funds from the state school fund. So for them to show up, it may be an anomaly. With regard to the programs that have been mentioned, this is what school boards do. They take a look at their debt, their ability, working with their taxpayers to pay on it. And if the state treasurer has concerns about that, we'd love to enter into these discussions to talk about this. But to be honest with you, we were somewhat taken aback. The treasurer did not talk to us about this. They didn't say there was a concern. And when you take a look at the pension obligation bond system, it's not one that is guaranteed by the state. It's a diversion agreement. The school districts have to enter into a diversion agreement with their bondholders that is then sent to the State Department of Education. And what happens is the state school fund is diverted to pay that debt service. There is no state guarantee of those. It is the school district who guarantees those with a funds diversion, or if the funds aren't there, if you as the legislature stop appropriating funds to the state school fund, by the way, I'm not advocating for that, but if you do stop doing that, it's the school district who's ultimately on the hook for that. It's the full credit of that school district. With regard to the state guarantee bond program, that's something we could talk about, but to be honest with you, this kind of stabs at the heart of local control of what local school boards are elected to do in balancing the interest. I understand there may be a state interest in this, and we're happy to enter into discussions with the treasurer's office on how we could work forward on this. But let's say you've got a district who they want to do a pension obligation bond offering because they're currently financing that at PERS at 7.5%, and the bond offering is much less, and they can save money and direct more dollars into the classroom for boys and girls in their instructional programs, and the treasurer says no. That school district doesn't have the ability to find those savings at that point. There may be a middle ground we can work out with the treasurer's office, but the way the bill's drafted in the Dash 1 amendments, we have some pretty significant concerns on the basis of our locally elected school boards. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? And I think there's a lot of people who don't understand how the school fund is used to balance out local revenues and to equalize across the state. And I think it was a shock to a number of people to understand that there are six districts that receive nothing from the state school fund because of the local tax that is coming in exceeds that that they would have gotten in the distribution fund.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm sure Senator Hass and his committee would love to have about a four-hour tutorial on how the state school fund operates and funds our schools. If you'd like to come down to the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, they talk about it on a daily basis.
That was yesterday's hearing.
Yep.
You covered it all?
And then some.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Those are the only two who were signed up for this bill. So if there's anybody out there that hasn't had a chance to speak today and wanted to do it on 303, now's your chance. Okay, seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on 303, and we'll get back to you as we decide how we want to move this and maybe talking to the people in the Senate Revenue. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 439. And with that, we'll have a short explanation.
That's what
the state funds. From our committee administrator, you can come on up too.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 439 establishes an outdoor education account for the purpose of providing outdoor school programs. There is a subsequent referral on this bill to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This bill may have a fiscal and revenue impact, but statements have not been issued. There are no amendments being considered at this time.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Rex Burkholder. I'm a volunteer member of the steering committee for the Oregon Outdoor Education Coalition, which is a new organization that's been formed to promote the benefits of using Oregon's tremendous natural settings to inspire, motivate, and engage Oregonians of all ages. Today, we're here to ask your support of Senate Bill 439, which would establish sufficient and sustainable funding for what is truly an Oregon tradition, outdoor school. And I'm going to summarize, given your time, I'm going to summarize my comments. You're in front of you there, and then turn it over to the folks here with the panel to talk more about this program and why it's so valuable and why it's so important to the state to fund that. Over the years, since outdoor school was first founded in 1957 in Curry County by some retired natural resource professionals who were concerned that children in their community were becoming too urbanized and not understanding where their natural resources and the economy came from, to by the 1970s, over 80% of children in the state of Oregon were able to attend a four-week program and learn about science, geology through getting muddy, about salmon and the cycles through actually wading in the waters, learning about forestry by cruising the forest and understanding how the system works together. The bad news is that since the 70s, and with all the tightening of school budgets, we've seen that only about half the kids in Oregon now, half the sixth graders in Oregon, get a chance to go to outdoor school. And the places where they do get outdoor school is typically a three-day program, which doesn't have the same impact on their educational outcomes as the full week gives you. So what I want to do is tell you just real quickly about the popularity of this program. Although I think I told you about that. Okay, as of 2012, a survey of the whole state, only about half kids are getting it now. And then we've done some research, and some other groups have done some research around the issues of outdoor education and outdoor school itself in terms of the public's perception. Here was a research from early in 2014, a general question: do you think it's important to get kids outdoors to learn about science and the environment? 93% of Oregonians thought it was very important, or is important, and 67% said extremely important or very important. Then this spring, we asked a question as we're thinking about, do we come to you and ask you for your help in funding this program? We asked the public, basically, would you support putting $20 million a year to ensure all Oregon kids get a chance to attend outdoor school? And here we had, again, two-thirds of the population saying that this is an important thing that we should fund. And the support, surprisingly, because we hear so much about urban-rural divides, this program actually has a greater support outside the Willamette Valley than inside the Willamette Valley. And the question is, why is that? The public recognizes that there's incredible benefits from programs like outdoor school, and you'll hear more about what it actually includes. But it's not just the academic. There are huge academic benefits in terms of retention, lower dropout rates, more engagement with school. But there's also the other very important aspects of education, building self-sufficiency and leadership skills, becoming good stewards of Oregon's natural resources, the collaboration skills, and getting kids just outside. Being active outdoors leads to better health as well. So I'm going to end my comments there and turn it over to our other panelists here. I'm not sure, is Ben or Randy going next? I think I am. Okay. Well, he didn't want to go after Ben because Ben will outshine us all about this program. But I'll let Mr. Schild introduce himself to you, and thanks you very much for the chance to introduce us to you.
Hi, thank you very much for your time. I'm Randy Shield. I'm superintendent of Tillamook School District. I'm in my 14th year in that district, although I started there as a first grader a long time ago. When I first became superintendent of Tillamook, we'd take kids out on field trips, and I remember my first year we took a group out, first and second graders, and we realized that we had five or six kids who had never been to the ocean before, and they lived in Tillamook. And every one of them was low income, or minority, or a combination of the two, and we realized that that's just not okay. We weren't going to let kids go through our system in Tillamook and not experience a place that we get to live. And so we started working to develop an outdoor education program. I'm going to talk to you just a little bit about that and then tie it into outdoor school. Our outdoor education program in 2001 was started by industry actually helping us hire a natural resource coordinator. And as we hired the natural resource coordinator, we started creating opportunities every year for different students to get out, for all students to get out and experience where we live and see the science behind that. We also decided that at that time that our goal in Tillamook wasn't going to be just to teach students how to be good at school, but our goal was going to be to teach students how to be good at life, how to be good at careers, how to be good at family, and how to be good citizens. And so a much broader scope than we'd had before. We teach our outdoor education and train the trainer model with basically our high school students doing most of the teaching them, bringing students out, and going forward with our activities so that they can have that experience. One of our concerns as you take kids out of the classroom is always around statewide assessment. So much of what we're graded on as schools are simply how we score on our statewide assessment. And so one of the things that we really had to look at is it worth our time? Is our time valuable? And I think we have, Rex, there's a pyramid on there. When you start looking at how students learn, if I were to hand you my notes today on this, you'd read through them and you might remember about 10% of what's there. But if I was able to give you my notes and you read those and I talked to you at the same time, you might get 20%. If we threw some pictures up on the wall, you might retain about 30% of that. But if I was able to pick you up, put you in a bus set, drive you down to Tillamook, and have you experience what our students get to experience, if you were there to see how they learned, you'd remember that for a long time, maybe forever. It says on the pyramid that you'd remember about 90% of what you were taught. And so that's the idea behind the experiential learning, getting kids out into the community. And as you know, we're still going to be graded on test scores, but you also know that our tests are going to change. And if you've looked at Smarter Balance is so much more about thinking and reasoning and critical thinking. And two times for each student, they're going to have to do a work sample of sorts, a performance task of sorts, in a way that will ask them to look at a situation. Many of those are going to be science related. And so for us in Tillamook, we've decided that the time that we spend outside of the classroom becomes extremely important, maybe just as important as the time that we spend inside the classroom if it's well developed. If you had a student, a child in our system right now, you'd see them in elementaries with a day at the bay, a day at the river. You'd see clamming, sand shrimp collection, tide pools, clean water festivals, anthropology days, all things like that. And in elementary, they all lead up to a culminating experience at sixth grade of outdoor school, where we spend a full week with our students in an outdoor setting to learn the various parts of not only outdoor education, but education in general. So every year we have to kind of question, do we know it's working? Is it having an impact? And the answer for us is yes. How do we know? Well, our graduation rate right now is 13% above the state average. We have the highest Latino population on the Oregon coast, and we have the highest graduation rate for Latino students in Oregon, 88% of our Latino students. We've engaged students along the way. and we've engaged them not just in the classroom, but outside of the classroom as well. And so I know it's working. I also know it's working because our kids are engaged in the community. Just last night, we had a culminating experience of a charity drive where our high school students raised $175,000 in 10 days for charity, most of which goes to Dornbecker's. And so we've engaged kids not only in our environment, but in our community. All of those things, you look together, you can tell that we're committed to outdoor education, we're committed to our communities and so forth, and yet last year we had to reduce our outdoor experience from 5 days to four because we couldn't afford it. And the reason we were able to do four was because of the Gray family helped us out. And so you know how committed we are, we know how important it is, and yet it's still a struggle for us to maintain based on our current and existing funding levels. And so for us, our job, educate kids more than just in the classroom. It has to be outside the classroom. We believe outdoor school is a huge piece to that puzzle, and outdoor education hugely important to every student. So thank you for your time.
Hi, my name is Ben. I am a fifth grader at Bonnie Slope Elementary in the Beaverton School District. Last fall, I went to outdoor school at Camp Westwind, and I loved it. We did three types of field studies. We looked at tide pools on the beach, we took a night hike, and learned how to make a spark by biting into a mint. In the estuary field study, we walked in the mud and learned to go ghost shrimping. We sang songs around the campfire and played games together. I'm a good student, but I've never really liked school very much. I think it's boring, but outdoor school wasn't boring at all. My parents say it's the first time they've ever seen me really excited about school. I sang all the songs for them, showed them what all the beads mean on my name tag, and even took them for a hike in the woods to show them all the plants I learned to identify. I was one of the Oregon students lucky enough to go to outdoor school. The district paid part of the cost, my parents paid part of it, and we fifth graders held a pancake breakfast to raise money to pay for the rest. Not all Oregon students are that lucky. Many families can't afford to pay part of the costs. Some school districts can't pay for part. Bonnie Slope has an active and organized community that supports their students, and not all schools have that. I think all Oregon students should have a chance to go to outdoor school. Just think how many other kids there are in Oregon. They are smart, but they don't like school. Many could even think school is so pointless that they will drop out someday. What if all they need is a spark of inspiration? Outdoor school could inspire a whole generation of scientists, environmentalists, artists, writers, teachers, and leaders. Outdoor school is great for Oregon's future, and you should make sure every Oregon student gets a chance to go. Thank you. And I also have some letters here from my class.
Put those in as evidence as well. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell, and I'm here to tell you what the bill that is before you does. It dedicates $22 million per year for outdoor schools so that every student in Oregon, whether they're in public, private, or homeschool, can attend a six-day, five-night outdoor school experience in either their fifth or sixth grade year. Key for this particular program is, one, the money would be distributed through a grant process through Oregon State University Extension Office that would have an evaluating committee that tries to maintain a balance. And what that balance does is it makes sure that we're covering the earth sciences, as is appropriate in each of the regions of the state, dealing with soil, water, plants, and animals, but also talks about the importance of Oregon's environment and at the same time the critical importance of natural resources to Oregon's economy and how we can use outdoor school as a way to familiarize young people with the outdoors so that they are more interested in taking an active part not only during their life in the outdoors but also seeking careers in the outdoors. Right now we're having a rather tremendous difficulty finding people who are interested in going into careers in agriculture, in timber, in forestry. We're hoping by making sure that outdoor schools are once again available to all the students in the state, we'll be able to connect them to career education and opportunities in that direction. But it's important that we have an opportunity to create that balance to make sure that that goes forward so that people understand that Oregon is a diverse place. But it's really important for those who happen to be sitting in downtown Portland, or those who happen to be in Pendleton, or those who are in Klamath Falls, that there are other places in this state that make Oregon special and give them a sense of place for Oregon. The bill, as it currently stands, is a general fund bill, but it integrates some critical elements for education, because you can't separate outdoor school from the requirements of the schools from which these young people come from. So it connects up with STEM as well as engineering, mathematics, and international standards. Part of the bills, by the way, there is amendments that we got not 10 minutes ago that will be coming to you, and those amendments make sure that we come back to the Department of Education to make sure that we're integrating properly with them. But it also goes one step forward. We heard when we did our interfacing with the public over the last several months that something that's very important to the Oregon public is that we teach our young people today leadership skills, the ability to cooperate with one another, and find problem-solving techniques that they can use as they go forward with their life. Our outdoor school program will be providing that. It also provides an excellent opportunity for people to experience different cultures throughout the state, to get them out of their where they live. For instance, Pendleton experiencing an opportunity to go to the coast, downtown Portland experiencing what it's like to go out to the timber area or an agricultural setting. And most importantly, making sure that we're mixing classes so that they have an opportunity to find out what other kids are like from different areas and become friends and generate those friendships. So that's what this bill is intended to do. And we are certainly capable of answering any questions, but I'm hesitant with the committee's time to go on myself. So if you have any particular questions we can address, I'd be happy to do that, or I'm sure the panel would as well.
So I'll just make a statement to begin with. Like you, I have always lived on the coast, originally in Port Angeles, Washington, but when I was a second-year teacher at Marshall High School in Coos Bay, we had homerooms. I asked our kids how many of them had been different places. And I was shocked to find out that I had 2 out of 27 who had never seen the Pacific Ocean, and they lived in Coos Bay. So it's hard to imagine when you live, you know, up a slough, up the river someplace, and you're on a farm, and there's responsibilities all year long, and it doesn't become a priority that they can get to be in ninth grade and still never have actually gone out and walked on a beach. So having those experiences has always been important. I've always thought it would be great to have centers in every one of our regions where we had facilities that kids could go to. I know that our schools in Coos Bay, especially elementary schools, the gyms were those places for people all over the state that would take advantage of outdoor kinds of activities and bring their kids from all over. And then we would hope to use their gyms to sleep in when we went the other direction, because those got equally inexpensive. So we need to, I believe very strongly, that this kind of education is really important. And I appreciate your testimony. Our young man did an outstanding job. We appreciate you being here and explaining why enthusiasm is as big an indicator of success in schools and learning as any of the other attributes we put on a list. It's how we can get your enthusiasm lifted to want to be a student again. So any other questions? Yes.
I echo what you just said, and I want to commend Mr. Burkholder and the others for coming forward with this. It's really an important part of our system. It's good for all of us when others see other parts of the world, and you know, I'm committed to sort of getting this back into the system somehow, and I applaud you for your work to try to make this a reality once again for everyone to have this opportunity.
Any other questions or comments from our committee?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time. Again, it appears that there is no one else who has signed up to talk about this bill from public testimony, or is there anybody? Oh, thank you. I missed it on the list. Come on up. Oh, yes, I do see Scott. Thanks. Thank you for being here. Sorry, they missed that one.
Understood.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. I'm Scott Reed. My role at Oregon State University is to serve as Vice Provost for Outreach and Engagement and Director of the OSU Extension Service. There's sound logic, I believe, to linking outdoor schools to the OSU Extension Service. Our 100-year history across the state with educators in every county emphasizes a 4-H youth development program, among other things. We enroll more than 100,000 K-12 kids in our 4-H program, making it what we believe is the largest informal youth development program in the state. Of special relevance is our having assumed as the organizational home for the Oregon Environmental Literacy Program in the last year that, as you might recall, was stimulated by the 2009 Legislative Act, No Child Left Inside. Extension also has expertise in the design of overnight residential camping experiences, which we think provides the ideal platform for working and helping to develop this outdoor school emphasis. Now, the priorities in Senate Bill 439 are consistent with what we have found to be critical learning goals. And as also described in the bill, we give extra effort to reaching those who are underserved by limitations of financial resources, location, or culture. If the bill and the program were to be implemented, this would allow OSU Extension to develop extra capacity to develop and adapt curriculum, to provide training, to deliver the program, to do quality monitoring, compliance, and evaluation, among other meaningful parts of outdoor school. We believe that a community of practice ultimately might be developed around the use of outdoor learning laboratories that will involve, as a base of operations at the university, many of our own matriculated students and our faculty researchers, so that we become a hub of learning and demonstration around what it means to have outdoor learning laboratories. Those communities of practice would no doubt include university students, researchers, and practitioners, among others. Now, as I close, you may know that the Extension Service, along with the Oregon Ag Experiment Station and the Forest Research Laboratory, comprise what are known as the OSU statewides, the statewide public services. A key concern of ours in the current legislative session is to recover some of the funding that has been lost over the last decade. The Board of Trustees at the university approved a $16 million funding request for the statewides last year. Such funds are really critical to our capacity to continue to meet the needs of Oregonians. So as I address the benefits that would be provided by Senate Bill 439, I'd be remiss in not emphasizing the need to address the critical capacity of the Extension Service as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Reed? Again, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
With that, anyone else to speak to Senate Bill 439? Seeing none, we'll close our public hearing on Senate Bill 439. And as was noted quickly, amendment for that bill just came available. I got a note myself as people were sitting up here. So you can go to OLIS and see the amendment as well before we have a reconsideration of this bill. So with that, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 447. And I want to thank our senator and House member. Ms. Fagan, if they want to come up while we have a short explanation of our bill, we would love to have the two up front. So thank you for being here.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 447 establishes a grant program to provide matching fund grants to school districts for capital costs. There is a subsequent referral on this bill to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This bill may have a fiscal and revenue impact, but statements have not been issued at this time. There are dash one and dash two amendments being considered.
Thank you very much. So with that, either of our two illustrious compadres can start. Okay.
Chair Roblin, distinguished senators, for the record, Shamia Fagan, State Representative for House District 51. Thank you for hearing me today on Senate Bill 447. As I think anybody with an ears or eyes knows, I am now a mom, and I remember distinctly in the last year or so when my husband and I had to move daycares. We went to this one place that was kind of state-of-the-art everything, and we went out on one of their decks, and there was a gap that was maybe, I don't know, 4 inches between the railing and the actual decking. And we had about a 10-month-old at the time that we were considering that, and though I now look back in retrospect and my son could not have fit down there, just the slight perception of insafety, of being unsafe on this deck that he would, you know, otherwise play on, was enough to not have us consider that daycare. My point being that I don't think there's anything more important to parents than making sure that their kids are in a safe place. And that is obviously something that's critical to Oregon parents when we talk about our schools. And so I'm happy to be before you today with thanks to the invitation of Senator Devlin to be a part of this bill to authorize $125 million in bonds for K-12 matching grants. In addition, we would establish and fund the Office of School Facilities and the Oregon Department of Ed as a resource for local school districts, particularly smaller school districts that might not have the resources to go out and do some of the studies that they would need to be able to do to put their schools up to seismic, tsunami, and other disasters. Also, just making sure that their facilities are safe. Even without a disaster, just that they're safe and sound facilities. A lot of smaller school districts don't have the bandwidth to be able to go out and hire experts the way that maybe larger school districts do. So to establish that Office of School Facilities in the Oregon Department of Ed and provide technical assistance and small grants to assess district needs, support long-term capital programs, and inform statewide capital planning. And finally, launch the Oregon School Safety's School Facilities Database to start building a repository of data for local districts and statewide capital planning info. So I know that Senator Devlin is going to talk more about the background of the bill, but this is something that is just absolutely critical as Oregon parents, Oregon kids every day go and spend the majority of their weeks really in public buildings, that it's an absolute requirement that we make sure that those are safe buildings for those kids and those parents. So with that, I will turn it over to Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. I'm here to speak in support of SB 447. For me, this has been about a six-year effort. This bill actually started out way back in about 2008, 2009. In the 2009 session is when I and then Speaker Hunt put forward a constitutional amendment, which actually passed. It was Measure 68, which was passed by Oregon voters by a 2-to-1 margin, putting in place what we now call P-bonds, which gives the state the ability to issue general obligation bonds on a matching basis for school districts to meet some critical needs. Now, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you may be surprised that I am here speaking about spending money. But I will tell you that I am here in support of this bill because I think regardless of where a child is in this state, if they are in a condition that is unsafe to their health, or if they're in a condition that simply, let's just say, how would I put it? I've been in some school districts throughout the state where roofs are not only leaking, they're leaking on children, where heating systems are not working, and there are areas of the state that are very cold. I've been in areas of the state where it isn't just the seismic issues that you'd worry about, it's actually whether or not the building would collapse without an earthquake. So just because a child is not in my district, I don't think that relieves me in any way as a state senator of responsibility that every child that is in a public school in this state should be in a reasonably safe environment. And there were some stops and starts after the voters actually approved that measure. I think there were some unrealistic things that were put forward during a period of time. And so I took on in the 2013 session sponsoring SB 540 to just do a little bit more background work to try to make a stronger case. I think the people that have worked with that task force, the 12-member task force, pretty diverse group, have been very impressed by the work that they have done. At the beginning of this whole process in 2013, you know, we had a lot of players, many of them not entirely on the same page. One of the players I would give a lot of credit to is the Center for Innovative School Facilities that has been working on this for a number of years. But a lot of times there were disagreements between these parties. Right now, the bill that before you has their support, the support of the Oregon School Boards Association, the support of the PTA, the support of COSA, the support of Stanford Children, the support of OEA, and the support of OSEA, and I think probably the support about of about anyone you talk to. Now, Representative Fagan has been very good in going through what the bill is supposed to do. But I would like to tell you a little bit about the background of some of those issues. I went to the group number of times and spoke before them, the task force, and urged them not to put forward something that's unrealistic. So they listened to me, and they only were just a little unrealistic. So the $125 million may not be possible this biennium. There are a lot of requests for bonding. But I do believe we have to go down this road, and I do believe we have to start funding some of these projects. And one of the things this really tries to do, if you get into the details of the bill that's before you, is to incentivize districts. A lot of districts have had considerable difficulty in passing the bond measures that they would need to pass in order to do some of these improvements. And this will provide a critical match to them so that they can go out to their constituents and make the case that if they'll put forward, in some cases, half the funding, that the state will put forward the other half. It also has limitations within the bill under how much funding is available per school district, and actually gives considerably more weight or ability so that, let's say, for instance, people would be concerned that some school districts would come in and just take the lion's share of the fund. So that there are limitations on how much a school district could take. There are also is a little bit broader capacity built into the bond for school districts that are having situations in terms of their tax base being inadequate to support the type of bonding that would be necessary. So if you're a school district that actually has significant issues with public lands and not too much in terms of in terms of value within the district, this could assist you in finally getting the approval for that bond. Also, we've found that not every school district out there has the ability to determine what their facilities needs are. I mean, some of them are struggling just to have a couple of people at the administrative level. So when we ask go out and evaluate the condition of your buildings, a little bit of grant funding could help them go quite a ways. And actually, if we could put a core staff in the Department of Education, which actually, I hate to say it this way, but which is viewed considerably better now, the department, Senator Cruz, not the OEIB, the department.
I would agree, Senator.
Yeah. Okay. That could be of assistance to school districts over time. What I'm basically asking you here today for is that when this does go to a work session, that you forward it on with a recommendation, a due pass recommendation, to the full Ways and Means Committee, but with understanding that this is going to go into a mix of a lot of needs that the state has in terms of capital. We just think that that discussion should occur and that we should continue this discussion, because the reality of this is, while we're responsible for this building and we're responsible for all state facilities, and our history is we are responsible actually for state facilities, our university system, which is very extensive, and we have assisted community colleges and we assist communities with some of their public facilities needs in terms of water and sewer in a very minimal way, and obviously we invest dollars in economic development. Just because school capital is not a direct responsibility of the state does not mean that we can evade our responsibility for every child in this state being able to be in a classroom in at least a reasonably safe environment. No one is talking about building new schools for every child in the state, but at least there should be an expectation that every child is in a safe, reasonably heated environment.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Yes.
A couple, if you could, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Thank you. Senator Devlin, I like this. Okay. I think this is a good bill. One of the things, I'm just going to throw a couple things at you because you will probably pay attention to this when it gets down there, I'm assuming. When we talk about seismic, mm-hmm. Okay, which is a massive hill I'm not sure we can ever climb. I guess I would suggest that we maybe look at things more in the inundation zone and look at buildings that have outlived their usefulness already. which would be both schools, hospitals, all sorts of things like that, which this bill doesn't address. I understand that. The question I have with this bill is this a place where we, where a school district could potentially go for infrastructure needs? For example, I mean, we're going to full day K and some school districts don't have the capacity. Would this be a place where that could happen? And I also want to know, in my part of the world, for a school district to pass a levy is damn near impossible. So, and hopefully with this match, it makes it maybe a little bit better. But I'm just wondering if you've considered the infrastructure needs for full day K, if that fits in here, or is that going to be in a different vehicle?
In terms of the infrastructure for full day kindergarten, you will see in the co-chair's budget, or actually their framework plan, one of the issues to be addressed in that is the implementation of full-day kindergarten and the capital needs that might be necessary to be able to do that. I'm not taking this as a negative, so please don't take this in as a negative. There was no language in the governor's recommended budget about this. I think we are well aware that there are going to be some school districts that will not be able to implement full-day kindergarten without some assistance. And I've heard numbers in the $25 million range, some a little bit more. But I think we're going to have to find a way, and it's outside of this,
okay,
although it could be incorporated into it just as easily. We're going to have to find some way to address that, because I'll give you an example. I believe it was the Monroe School District, which is down in the southernmost part of Benton County. I visited that school district a few months ago, and the superintendent there, and Monroe is about, memory, 400 plus students, 600, around 600 or so ADMW, maybe 550. A lot of students in poverty, not a particularly high ELL rate. But the superintendent there said, I'd love to have full day kindergarten, love to have it, but I got no place to put it. But my only hope is that I can go out and buy a used temporary classroom for $100,000, $150,000, $180,000, because that's the only way I'm going to be able to do it. But the kids here need it. So, I mean, I think some of those school districts, it can't be like, I'd like to make this classroom look nicer, or I think I got to, you know, do some things to, I don't know. It's got to be, there's just no way you're going to do it, because the funds won't go that far. So, but I think the co-chairs are well aware of this,
okay,
and I think we'll ensure that our capital construction subcommittee is well aware of it.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator Devlin. I knew you were aware of that, and I knew that's a concern for you. I just wanted to put it on the record.
Okay.
Any other questions for these witnesses? Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here. So with that, we're going to ask Morgan Allen. It's Nicole Schott from Condon. And also... So Morgan's not here. So David.
Morgan wants to come. He's no. here.
He's, oh, he's shy. He's not speaking.
No.
Gotcha.
He's just very shy today.
So. He's just here for questions. Dave, is it Cumberland from Pendleton? We always defer to those people who have traveled a little farther, and these two have traveled more than the 100 miles. So they moved up the list just because that's something we like to have happen for those people who are willing to come that far to come and talk. So. We'll start with two of you. You want to come on up to
go ahead, Nicole.
Our OSBA?
I should go first.
No, go ahead first.
Okay. Chair Roblin and the members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing me. My name is Nicole Schott, and I am a board member at the Condon School District. Condon is located in Senator Haskell's district in north central Oregon. Our community is about 700 people, so I'm sure there's more people in this building than live in our community. As with most of rural Oregon, our population has declined over the years. Currently we have about 127 students, which is about half of what we had about 20 years ago, actually more like 13 years ago. So to address this reduction in students and also funding, we have cut our staff in half. We've consolidated classes. We have one principal, and we use a part-time superintendent. We've done all that we can operationally to reduce our costs to manage the funding that we receive from the state. We also get support from our county court, which has helped us to keep providing the quality education we want to our students. We have two facilities. We have a high school campus and a grade school campus, which are a few blocks apart. We believe the next step to be able to streamline and reduce our costs are to move onto one campus with a K through 12 education system. To do that, we're going to move to the high school because it's only 50 years old instead of 100 years old. And we will need to add on to the high school 4 classrooms for the consolidated grade school classes. And then we also, while we go out for the bond, want to do improvements to our grade school or to the existing high school building to make it so that it's more energy efficient, new boilers, and repair things that have deteriorated over the 50 years. This bill 447, it was like it was written for us, even though we had no part in the writing of it. We have around 60% free and reduced lunch population of kids, so we meet that requirement. Our tax base is only $167 million, which is less than a third of what our neighbor to the north has. And we have strong community support, so I believe with the match, we could actually make this work for our community. We passed a bond about 13 years ago. Our taxpayers passed that. We've passed 2 levies. Our community really does support our school, and I think they'll get behind this if we can make the cost to our taxpayers manageable. And we, with the project that we're looking at and the bill as it's designed now, we hope to qualify for a $2 million grant. So even though that might be nothing to some schools, it would make an enormous difference to us. So I'd just like to close by saying that schools are the heart of small communities, and that support of this bill would not only support the education of our students, but it would be an economic development driver. It would create construction jobs for the short term, but in the long term, it would allow us to have a stronger school, which could help at least maintain some of the population that we have and maybe even attract some people in the future. So please give your support to Senate Bill 447.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Senators. I'd like to thank you folks for the opportunity to appear before you. Senate Bill 447 is the outcome of a second task force on facilities. There was actually one 4 years ago, and I've served on both. Love the drive down here, by the way. It's very fascinating every time. Anyway, I serve on the Pelham School Board. I've been on there 16 years now. I'm currently the state president for the Oregon School Board Association, represent 197 school districts. The one that isn't belong to OSBA is almost in Idaho, I believe, or Nevada. Nevada, yeah. Lori's there to help me out here all the time. Anyway, we strongly support the bill. We also, as Senator has said, Devlin, we have the support of COSA, OEA, Stand for Children, practically all the alphabet soup of the education folks. Basically, we need this bill. We need the additional capital funding. We passed a bond in Pendleton 2 years ago. We were very fortunate. We spent 2 years planning it. We spent a lot of time promoting it, and we got it passed. We're building 2 new buildings. We're adding on to the K-12 and the P part, the child care, the
the whole thing is going to be moved into one building, and hopefully we'll be able to take care of that. If this program had been in place at the time, we could have gotten maybe an additional $4 to $5 million and done more expansion, better facilities, better programming available for the students. So I just want to pass that on. Well, I think one of the big parts of the bill that's going to be very helpful, and realizing, as the Senator Devlin said, we probably won't get the whole $120 million to start with, but if we can get the Office of School Facilities set up in the ODE and provide the planning grants and stuff for the small schools to help them particularly do the planning necessary, do the environmental assessments, do the master planning that's necessary if you're going to do a good job of putting a school plan together. And I think that piece is just extremely important to it, as well as the capital matching bond. So with that, I should be happy to answer questions. I've got notebooks full of stuff if you want more information. I understand there's some amendments floating around, and I've looked at those, and they're supportable, so I don't think that'll be a problem. So any other questions? Great.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So we're getting really close to our time. We've got a couple more minutes, and there are some people who have come today. We'll carry this hearing over for some of the people who are regulars. So Joel and Scott, you're probably going to be here next Monday or Tuesday. But Ted Wolf, Matt Donahue, Klein, Yamhill School District, and Joel Smallwood. There's four seats. We'll put you all up here. We'll see you get you all, because you are not our regular people. You come here occasionally. So
first time.
And great to see Joel, who was used to be over 100 miles from here, but he moved. So he used to work in Coos Bay School District. So I've known Joel for a long time. So we'll get your testimony. Try to keep it as short as you can, a minute or so each if you can, and we'll get your testimony today. So thank you.
Chair Roblin and members of the committees, my name is Sharan Klein. I'm the superintendent of the Yamhill Carlton School District. I believe I'm the only superintendent testifying today, so I want to be emphatic that our superintendents around the state really would like this bill. We're highly in support of it. We would like to acknowledge, though, that we understand that school construction is primarily responsibility of the local district, and we're not advocating that that should change. This bill just gives us the tools to help us help ourselves. While there's many reasons for our support, I'd like to emphasize three. In most small and medium districts around the state, it's very difficult to pass a capital construction bond. Many of us are located in communities that are just frankly not all that interested in raising their taxes. A match that's proposed would give us some very needed leverage to help us convince folks and give them a reason to vote yes. Second, this bill creates a second bucket of funds specifically for facility funding and begins to get Oregon on par with four of the other states around the nation that do state support of facilities. Third is the reality of most districts like mine have been cutting back on our facility maintenance for so long that we're teaching our students in buildings that are distracting, learn in, and in some cases are neither safe nor healthy. So I know I don't have much time, so just a few things about my district I'd like you to understand is our district's small. We have about 1,200 students in it. It's a rural district with an agricultural base. It's very politically conservative, and while the people there are generous, they're just not that interested in raising their taxes. If I could build a school with a barn raising, I could have it done tomorrow. I could. They don't particularly want to vote yes. We have done facilities assessments. We've got $6 million worth of just repairs in our buildings between heating systems, mortar and bricks that are failing, roofs that are failing, science classrooms that are falling apart, equipment that's outdated, you name it. Our last gym was built in 1965. Locally, they still call it the new gym. But this is before Title IX, before the capacity needed to double. Anyway, so thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, thank you for your time. I'm Joel Smallwood. I'm the facilities director for Silver Falls School District. I'm also president-elect of the Oregon School Facility Managers Association, which has representatives from nearly every district in the state. Let me tell you a bit about my district and why these points are so important. My district is comprised of 13 campuses serving 3,800 students through 12th grade in buildings ranging from the late 1800s to 2010. The majority of our buildings were constructed in the 50s and have never had a major renovation. On average, our district poverty level is at 42%. Our community has been successful in only two of the last eight attempts since 1980. Our district has a very limited tax base due to lack of industry and being comprised largely of agricultural land. Can tell you about that Senate Bill 447 could do for us. As you might guess, we in districts like ours statewide are strong supporters. While there are many reasons for our support, I'd like to point out one in particular in my district. We currently house 475 K-3 students in a building constructed largely in 1920 that sits between two state highways where the district does not own a single parking space. A city street is closed morning and afternoon to accommodate busing. Portions of the building were condemned in the late 1960s, and the board at that time deemed the building beyond its useful life and slated it for no further major capital improvements. Six attempts to remedy this have failed since that point, the most recent being a $24.9 million bond this last November that failed with approximately 57% no vote. The board was determined that something simply must be done. We are currently looking at reoccupying portions of a school that was largely closed in 2010 because of its inadequacies, while leaving its worst areas unoccupied and housing for students and housing our students in portable classrooms in the parking lot in the future. Funding for this temporary solution will come from the district taking out a loan and potentially impacting its general fund into the future service to service that debt. A matching grant may have avoided that situation. My district was unified in 1997, bringing multiple small districts under the umbrella of the Silver Falls School District. While we are unified in name, vision, dedication to providing best education to every student, we are certainly not unified when it comes to the funding of facilities. Attempts to pass a bond that has something in it for everyone inherently become so large that they are simply unaffordable for our district. And bond measures that are trimmed down to manageable size lose support because they serve such a small portion of our constituents. We feel having a matching grant available may be just enough to tip the scale in our community so people don't feel that they are footing the entire cost of a school that will never directly impact their individual community, their children, or their grandchildren. Thank you.
Thank you. A couple minutes if you can.
Fairly
yep. Quickly. But thank you.
Absolutely. For the record, Matt Donahue, chair of the Task Force for School Capital Improvement Planning, public finance, banker, and financial advisor for D.A. Davidson. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak briefly today in support of Senate Bill 447. I am not only a banker and financial advisor working with school districts around the state, but I'm also a former teacher and also parent of two girls in the first and second grade at Laurelhurst School in Portland, a school that was built in 1928. I had the privilege and honor to serve as chair of the Task Force for the School Capital Improvement Planning, whose recommendations form the basis of Senate Bill 447, along with 11 Oregonians on the task force who volunteered many hours to research this topic. We are proud of the recommendations and excited that Senate Bill 447 will put in place a statewide facilities program for Oregon schools. Oregon is only one of nine states in the country that does not have a statewide system for planning, funding, and tracking its school facilities. SB 447 will change that. SB 447 puts in place several tools to help school districts, as Sharan said, help themselves in upgrading their facilities. First, a matching program that will encourage district voters to invest in their local school facilities, and grants that will begin to alleviate the disparity in property values across school districts in Oregon. Second, technical assistance in planning and assessment grants for districts to manage their facilities needs. Third, funds for grants to districts with dire facility needs who haven't been able to pass bonds three times. Fourth, an Office of School Facilities to manage these programs. Provide technical assistance to districts and coordinate statewide school facility planning and information gathering. Task Force believes that the Senate Bill 447 will put Oregonians to work improving learning environments for all Oregon school children and the educational professionals that work with them. Thank you for your time, and I greatly appreciate your support of the bill.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Edward Wolf. I'm a science writer, a parent, and I was proud to serve as a member of the Senate Bill 540 Task Force. I'm going to just make a couple of quick points in summary that relate to the testimony you've already heard. One of the things that we learned as a task force in thinking about the scope of the need around the state of Oregon is that 85 school districts in Oregon, 43% of districts statewide, have tried and failed or have not tried at all to pass school bonds since 1997. Nearly 60,000 Oregon children attend school in these districts. You've heard a lot of the information that we covered as a task force. I'll just reiterate the benefits that we see Senate Bill 447 delivering to the state. We're confident that it will improve health and safety for students, teachers, and staff. We're confident it will result in more effective teaching and learning in improved and modernized learning environments. We know that it will create family wage jobs in construction and building trades throughout Oregon communities, benefiting all those communities directly. And we know that it will create fiscal leverage that multiplies the impact of every state dollar invested. The state match creates an incentive for local voter support that will increase total capital investment in K-12 schools around Oregon. So it's time to do what Senate Bill 447 proposes, and to establish an Office of School Facilities and to invest in the schools that Oregon students deserve. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? I appreciate your testimony. Thank you for being here. Great to see you, Joel. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 447. And we're going to schedule a hearing on continuation of this hearing, 447, and Senate Bill 519. We'll move both those over to February 26th. I think that works out best for us. Is that right? Hopefully by that time we'll also have the amendments on this bill so we can also have work sessions. So we'll be doing that. If there are any other things to come before the committee, seeing none. We're going to close the Senate Education Committee hearing today. Thank you very much. Committee hearing today. Thank you very much. Thank you.